Coming up on the program today, climate change and the highest court in the land. Also, making America great again doesn't come cheap. You know how Donald Trump is paying the bills. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 10th of February, Wednesday. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. First of all, just because I know you're dying to know, and because we previewed it yesterday, Fed Chair Janet Yellen did indeed spend some time on Capitol Hill today, delivering what is formally called the Fed's semi-annual report on monetary policy. Here's the short version, and I am quoting her now. Financial conditions in the United States, she said, as only Fed chairs can, have recently become less supportive of growth, end of quote. Dr. Yellen is, however, nothing if not consistent. She also said it's too soon to say what the Fed might do on interest rates when next it meets. That would be March the 15th and 16th. Put that in your calendars. For the record, by the way, her opening statement, 2012 words, just so you know. The Supreme Court of the United States sits directly across First Street from the Capitol, and it was there last night that the justices made some news, bringing one of the centerpieces of the Obama administration's climate change plan. That'd be rules limiting power plant emissions. They brought that plan to a screeching halt. Scott Tong on the Marketplace Sustainability Desk has been following this story all day long for us. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
First of all, give us the Supreme Court primer here. What exactly did the justices say yesterday?
They said something extraordinary. They issued a stay. That is, a majority, five justices, pushed the pause button on an EPA rule to get power plants to cut their emissions. The court hardly ever does this. And so why? Well, they didn't really say, but the standard to meet is whether the challenge to the rules has a reasonable likelihood of success. And that's what worries backers of this rule, including Vicky Arroyo. She directs the Climate Center at Georgetown Law.
The concern, of course, is that some of the justices at least feel like there is a legitimate legal argument against EPA. Having said that, that argument hasn't been fully briefed and heard by either the Supreme Court or the D.C. Circuit.
So this is a regulation that the court has stayed, but we're talking about the entire electricity system here, right? Nothing really more fundamental to the economy than power, yeah?
Well, a couple legal observers see it that way. I mean, let's remember, electricity is one of the greatest inventions ever. Right? Without that, we have no screens or phones, no gas pumps, no emergency services, no water. There's a joke that if you lose your internet, you're back to 1979. If you lose your power, you're back to 1879. I mean, that's what's at stake here. So the challenge is to modernize, clean up the power system, and still keep everything on.
Right, right. And that's a good joke. I hadn't heard that one before. But the electricity, the energy industry, really, right? The power generation industry is already changing, moving away from coal and all of that.
Coal is struggling independent of the Clean Power Plan. I mean, if there's a war on coal, it's being waged by a rival in the marketplace,
right?
Natural gas from fracking. It's cheap. There's a whole lot of it. Wind power is becoming very competitive and solar's coming on. And then you add clean energy subsidies and other regulations that make life hard for coal. So I spoke to environmental lawyer Thad Lightfoot at Dorsey & Whitney today, and he has some clients in the power sector. And he says this business is already changing, already getting cleaner.
Moving away from coal, even the parties that have challenged the Clean Power Plan, I think, are moving toward addressing the issues.
Now, he thinks in the end, what could change here is some of the details, some of the timing of the Clean Power Plan implementation, rather than upending the whole thing. The Supreme Court has already ruled several times on a big question. The EPA, yes, it can regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Law.
All right, back this out for me a little bit and get me away from what's going on in the courts, which is going to take a long time anyway.
Yeah.
talk to me about the bigger climate change picture overall.
Well, here in Washington, the politics of this is everyone assumes the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on the merits. Now, perhaps it'll be next year, which means the next president, and he or she will decide how hard to push this issue, whether to remain a party to this litigation. So that's important politically. And globally, the whole world is watching us, right? America is the biggest historic emitter. CO2 stays up there for hundreds of years. And perception matters. At the Copenhagen talks back in 2007, when the U.S. was seen as not doing much on climate, the talks fell apart. In Paris, when the U.S. was seen as committed, the deal passed.
Huh. Marketplace's Scott Tong on what turns out to have been a rather large late afternoon ruling from the Supreme Court yesterday. Scott, thanks very much.
Okay. You're welcome.
Shares in big utilities had a surprisingly unchanged day today, given what the Supremes had to say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the things the Fed and economists everywhere really look at as they try to figure out where the economy is headed is how consumers are feeling, you and me, because as we often hear, consumer spending makes up almost 70% of the American economy. In 2015, in point of fact, consumer spending came to a somewhat staggering $12.3 trillion with a T dollars. But if you think we spent $12 trillion going crazy at the mall, yeah, no. Marketplace's Nova Sappho is on this one.
Come with me into the minds of how economists think. Bring a flashlight. On the one hand, some of the $12 trillion in consumer spending last year did go to things like
motor vehicles that you purchase, furniture, those are your durable goods. Non-durable goods are things with a shorter lifespan like food and clothing.
That's Kyle Brown with the Bureau of Economic Analysis. He's in charge of the team that adds up how much stuff we buy. But here's the twist. The 70% of GDP that's consumer spending isn't just about what we actually spend out of our wallets.
It's also going to capture spending on our behalf.
And that's a broad category, from money that nonprofits spend to help people, to money spent by political campaigns, and even healthcare costs that the insurance company pays for you, says Chris Christopher of IHS Global Insight.
In the example of healthcare, where it's not necessarily coming out of people's pockets, it is sort of useful to understand how much of medical services is being actually consumed.
Basically, economists care less about who is spending money and more that it's being spent. The trouble, says Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute, is when we misinterpret that giant share of GDP.
I think there's a sort of critique of the U.S. economy that relies on the claim that, you know, too much short-termism and people are too materialistic.
Far from shopping at the mall, Bivens says, over the last few decades, it's been spending on staples like healthcare, education, and rent that has been a major part of GDP growth. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
The presidential campaigns, the ones that are left anyway, have put New Hampshire firmly in the rearview mirror and are moving on to the next states up in the electoral calendar, South Carolina and Nevada. Before he got on his plane last night, though, Donald Trump gave a victory speech, as he earned, and in which he said, among other things, this.
I think one of the things that really caught on, it's very important, self-funding my campaign. Everybody.
Nicholas Confessori had a story in the New York Times just the other day about Mr. Trump and his campaign finances, so we got him on the phone. Nick, it's good to talk to you again.
It's good to be here, Guy.
That claim that he is self-funded is not entirely true.
That's right. You know, the average self-funder will donate to their own campaign as much money as they need to run for president. And under the law, you can donate as much as you want to your own campaign. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is doing something a bit different. First of all, almost all the money of his that's in the campaign is money he loaned the campaign. Donald Trump actually gets a fair amount of money from grassroots donors who are sending in checks or buying those hats and T-shirts mm-hmm. that make America great again, hats and T-shirts. And when you actually look at the total amount his campaign has spent, what you realize is that half of it is covered by those small donors, and a quarter of it is money he's actually paying back to his own companies for services rendered.
There is, to a certain degree, what he's doing. He's moving money from one pocket to the other, basically.
That's right. So the way Trump is doing it, which is legal, by the way, is mm-hmm. he bills his companies bill him for those services. So when a person is borrowed from the Trump Organization to go work on the campaign pays the Trump Organization for that person's time. But where does that money come from? It comes from Donald Trump in large part. So essentially, the $2.7 million of his campaign spending that went to his own companies is really coming out of his left pocket and then going back into his right pocket.
So spitball it for me now as we go to South Carolina, Nevada, and Super Tuesday and all the rest of them. Does this spending pattern hold with him, or does the dynamic of the economics of the politics then change?
Well, it's a great question. And we said this in our story that You could look at his cash flow at the very end of 2015, which is when we last have information for. What we were seeing was that his expenditures to companies he did not own himself were actually rising very rapidly. They doubled between August and November. So one theory here, Kai, is that he started out in the campaign as a lark for himself.
Right.
It wasn't costing him much because of the free media. People were buying all those hats, and he was winning and leading. And then all of a sudden it got serious. He began to lead for so long that it began to seem possible that he could actually win the nomination. And it may be that sometime late last year and in the last month, he began to step it up and his campaign began to look and resemble more of a traditional campaign with traditional spending. So it could be changing.
Nick Commissori is a political reporter at The New York Times. Nick, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, by the way, Hillary Clinton and her ties to Wall Street. Also, how Bernie Sanders is going to pay for all that stuff he's promising. European Union diplomats meet in Brussels tomorrow to consider a deal that would give Britain more control over its affairs and the EU less of said control. One of the big issues is what benefits ought to be available to people who move to Britain from other EU countries. Some Brits are worried about the current record levels of migration there as the UK's relatively strong economy draws people from both poorer countries inside the EU, also refugees from Syria and elsewhere. Nowhere in the UK is the scale of immigration more evident than in London, as the BBC's Vincent Dowd reports.
A couple of years ago, Ben Judah decided to write about the effect migration is having on London. He could see it was changing poverty, but he also suspected that wasn't the entire story. Ben suggested we meet in Barking in East London, one of the suburbs whose transformation he has chronicled.
Immigrant London is now happening really on the edge of the city, and Barking is an old white working class suburb, and this is where poverty is accumulating, out of sight and out of mind to the establishment.
Wester from Ghana is one of the new East Londoners in the book. He works as a cleaner.
When you told your friends in Ghana you were going to London, what did they say?
Some people back home think Europe, you become, you know, a rich man overnight. Because when we see your pictures on Facebook, we know you guys are languishing in riches and all that. You're just being a miser. You're just being stingy. Life is not all that milk and roses here. I had a dream of becoming a system engineer, Microsoft system engineer. I've kind of gone astray.
Cleaning is one of the jobs dominated by recent migrants. Another is caring.
In London, over 60% of the carers are migrants, and they're doing the toughest jobs in this city, basically helping the English die, living on low pay. To be poor in the new London is to be tired, often working two jobs.
Which, however tough, is the sort of job stability many recent migrants crave.
This is a street curb where guys from Eastern Europe come and tout for work. They have to haggle for how much they're going to be paid. We see white vans going past. The lowest pay I ever saw in a street curb like this was one chicken and chips for a day's work. London glows in the villages of Africa, Eastern Europe and Asia, stirring up dreams. And that dream is that if you can make it to London, you've got a chance of being transformed into something else, something much more successful.
Ben's book also uncovers success stories, such as Polish builder Mariusz.
So if I came from your hometown and I asked you, should I come to London, what would you say?
Come over. I own three companies at the moment. I've got some rental properties. I own the house. I'm very happy, you know.
Do you think your children will be English first or Polish first?
They're going to be more English than Polish.
One of the things that I'm very proud about in London, and I think is something to take a lot of comfort in and not be too worried, is the enormous amount of mix that's going on. So I think it's very important to listen to the stories of migrants and what they think about coming to Britain, because if you intend to live here and have children or grandchildren here, there's over 50% chance that your grandchildren's story will be as much of a migrant heritage as of your heritage.
The BBC's Vincent Dowd on the streets, as you could hear, of London. Coming up.
Yeah, it may seem a little bit like magic, but I promise you it's not.
No, it's not. It's money, the green, green money of corporate bonus time.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 99 points today, 0.6%, closed at 15,914. The NASDAQ up 14 points, about 1/3%, 4,283. The S&P 500 off just a hair, let's call it even, 1,851. Good news, bad news for the Walt Disney Company and its earnings after the bell yesterday. The good news, the Star Wars Force Awakens movie, that one, remember that one? Yeah, it lifted the company to record income and beat Wall Street expectations. The bad news was that the sports network ESPN was a drag, showed a decline in profit in the quarter. Disney shares off 3.25% today. From the energy sector, solar power division, SolarCity said growth would slow this year and that losses in this quarter will be worse than expected. That's never good when they say that. Shares took a tumble off 29%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to, and really, you don't need Janet Yellen, you need the bond market. That's what you need to follow. 1.67% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Political campaigns have been all over the revolution in big data since at least the Obama win of 2008. But even they would look like pikers compared to what's going on today, thanks in no small part to the phones that we've all got in our pockets. There was an interesting thing that happened in the Iowa caucuses that's worth some time exploring here. Tom Phillips is the CEO of Distillery. That's an advertising technology firm based out of New York. Tom, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
What is it exactly that you guys did in Iowa?
Well, we watched each of the caucus locations for each party, and we collected mobile device IDs. It's a combination of data from the phone and data from other digital devices. We actually associate the devices of any one individual and figured out what distinguished that population, what was unusual about that population.
And then you can tell who's going to Republican caucus sites, who's going to Democratic caucus sites, all of that stuff.
Right. So we, at each of the Republican caucus sites, we collect a pool of devices, right? And then we track on a regular basis 100-some-odd behaviors.
Like what?
For instance, of the caucus goers that had family characteristics. They were working parents. They were stay-at-home parents. They bought kids' clothes. They bought kid back-to-school clothes. Mm-hmm. They were way over-indexed in Republican caucuses where Cruz won, and they were evenly split between Clinton and Sanders.
Hmm.
More interesting, I think, is we called it the householder index. I think it's more of a lumberjack index, but it's the people who are grill masters, do-it-yourselfers, lawn and garden folks, hardware buyers, overwhelmingly Trump, right? Trump's caucus sites, mm-hmm, way over index for those householders. Almost across the board, sports fans, that is NCAA, NFL, NBA, NHL, they way over indexed at caucuses where Rubio won on the Republican side, Sanders won on the Democratic side. Across all those.
Sanders, really?
Exactly. I wouldn't have expected that. Here's the exception.
Wow.
This one's funny. NASCAR. It was the one outlier.
Yeah.
Trump and Clinton. So in Clinton's counties, NASCAR way over-indexed. Who would have thought?
We've been talking about Iowa. This doesn't really work, for example, in New Hampshire, where everybody goes to the same polling location, right? So how useful is this, South Carolina, Nevada, all of them?
Well, here's what's interesting. In New Hampshire, the problem is the same polling place for both parties, right? So as soon as you merge those populations, you end up with kind of gray because the Republicans look a lot different than Democrats in almost every way, right? So as soon as you put those two together and you don't distinguish between the two, you don't get much signal. But listen, upcoming Nevada, South Carolina, Alaska, North Dakota, Kentucky, Wyoming, Maine, Nebraska, all separate days. Hmm. So we can go to those primaries and actually pull data on any one of those primaries and get Republicans one day, Democrats another.
Sounds like a business opportunity to me, Tom. I don't
know. You'd think. It's a cool way to flex our muscles. We think we have a pretty good business with major marketers.
Tom Phillips, the CEO of Distillery. Tom, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
Furrowed brows don't make for great radio. You can't actually hear the scrunching up of foreheads. But if you could, you'd be hearing them in HR departments from Wall Street all the way to Silicon Valley. It's bonus season right about now, and a lot of industries pay their bonuses. And it is an extremely expensive set of transactions, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, but not because of the bonuses themselves.
Chris Ochterbeck was pretty happy at a sales job in the oil business until he wasn't.
Some of the strategy and some of the behind the scenes that just started to be a little bit more discouraging.
He knew he wanted to quit, but he didn't because money. As in bonuses.
Because of the shares vesting at the end of the year, as well as the commission payout, it all just kind of made sense to wait out a few more months.
But when he got that bonus, he was so out of there.
I think my bosses were definitely surprised at my departure.
The thing is, this happens every year around bonus time in industries from Silicon Valley to Wall Street to big law firms. Bonuses drop and employees get the hell out. This is an expensive problem.
You know, the cost of losing an employee is much, much higher than it seems.
Josh Burson is principal of Burson by Deloitte at Deloitte Consulting. Yeah, sure, there's the recruiting, the advertising cost, the time required, morale is hurt.
The bigger problem is that you lose the learning curve of that person. The first few months that you have an employee, you're really not actually making any money by having that person because they're learning how to do their job, so they're relatively unproductive.
In dollars, the cost of replacing an employee can be 1.5 to sometimes 3 times the position's annual salary. And there's another cost. Some departing employees have sticky fingers.
There's certainly a spike in discovered or suspected data theft immediately after the bonus season is over.
Winston Crone is with Kivu Consulting, a cyber forensics firm. And in this job market, where it is a lot easier for people to find another job, it is a lot easier to quit. And growth industries like Silicon Valley have sent out armies of poachers. Again, Josh Burson with Burson by Deloitte.
It's actually very cyclical with the economy. Right now, out here where I live, the job market is so hot, talent acquisition and HR execs are in a panic.
So companies are trying to figure out if you're going to quit beforehand, possibly even before you know yourself.
Sometimes just seeing changes in behavior in computer usage or downloading or other types of communications can be a sign you may have a group of people who are unhappy.
Christine Lyon is a partner at law firm Morrison & Forster.
And I think what we'll see over time with big data especially is more employers trying to kind of read the tea leaves.
David Weisbeck does exactly that. He's chief strategy officer at Vizier. They help companies use big data to predict who's at risk of leaving.
Yeah, it may seem a little bit like magic, but I promise you it's not.
It goes well beyond checking whether someone is updating their LinkedIn profile.
People tend to leave in patterns. They don't tend to leave from a statistics point of view, in pure randomness.
Vizier sifts through a lot of data to look for these trends.
Organizations collect more data about employees than we ever have.
These days, employees are tracked in the interview process before they're even hired. They're tracked in orientation, in training.
We know what they're paying them. We know what benefits they have. We know what they're claiming in benefits and when.
The patterns that Vizier susses out are different for different companies.
We had one organization that is... Well, I'll say they're in a prairie state. They have to do a lot of relocations of talent.
So they started looking at how far away new hires were from home, from where they grew up.
And what the relationship was between that and turnover. And they found a very strong relationship there.
Other useful info? When was the last time someone was promoted? Is she underpaid, even if she doesn't know it? Weisbeck says his algorithms are 10 times more accurate than guesses from people in HR. He says it can give companies time to convince people to stay.
Look at those individuals now and understand what are their drivers and what would make them more successful in an organization.
So you might have an algorithm to thank for your next raise. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Burger King flat out goes crazy. They are adding hot dogs to the menu. Spent a year and a half on R&D, including how to get actual grill marks on the thing. $1.99 is the starting price point. You can have it two ways, a classic dog with relish, chopped onions, ketchup and mustard, or a chili cheese dog. The company said it wants to offer, and this is a quote, the Whopper of hot dogs. I don't know. That's all we got. The Dow off 99 points today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ up 14 points, a 3rd percent. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, 1,851. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.